Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Good morning. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Shalom.
Gentlemen.
Good morning.
How are we doing?
Doing good. Good morning, gents. I'm doing great.
But is it a morning? What do you mean by good morning?
To the listener, this is a morning.
I suppose I mean all those things.
What do you mean that it's good?
It's not good. Or it is good.
Tim's brain is mush.
All right.
I'm falling apart.
So we, in this episode, let me turn my head over here. We don't have any listener interaction that we're going to deal with. Mm-mm. I think we're just going to go straight for it here. So
let's do it.
What's in this episode? We have Books and Business, where I'm going to mention a quote. I haven't named it on the document because I think you guys will be able to figure out what it is. And I'm going to comment on that. Andy's going to comment on Adorning the Dark by Peterson.
Yep. Andrew Peterson.
And Tim has a quote from A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and A Great War.
Yeah.
Which I really want to read that.
It's your Booksing Day
book. Booksing Day gift. I've enjoyed it. It's been fun blast back to the past and history. Yeah.
I wondered. I know you'd love it, Charlie. I know you'd love it.
Yeah. And then for the main content, Tim is going to be talking about the proverbial woman, Proverbs 31 woman.
Yeah.
Yep. Or be in Proverbs 31.
But it's like all of Proverbs 31. Everybody looks at the Proverbs 31 woman and they just talk about the hymn starting at verse 10. But I'm going to be mainly in verses 1 through 9.
So Proverbs 31, not the woman.
You said a hymn. You said they talk about the hymn?
So they call a hymn, H-Y-M-N.
Thank you. That's what I wanted, because you're like, hymn, the Proverbs 31 woman. Yeah, I'm like, we should clarify.
The hymn to the valiant woman, the hymn to the warrior woman.
They, them.
Yeah. Well, now there's only two. There's only two genders now.
So that's within this episode. I think we're ready to go.
Books and Business.
Talk about some books.
So, A Hobbit, A Wardrobe, and A Great War. The chapter, I think it's 2, The Funeral of a Great Myth. I hope it's chapter 1. What was the great myth? The great myth was that society is improving, science is going to usher us into the age of peace and prosperity.
Myth of progress.
The age of progress, exactly. And part of that was eugenics. And so in that world, they were, if people were like defective or whatever, they were sterilizing some of them. And so that was part of the conversation. What I found interesting in the quote that I have here, it's the church's relationship to the whole eugenics conversation back in the 1910s, 20s, that time period. So here's the quote from verse 19. Catholics and conservative Protestants resisted these laws, but the eugenic tide appeared to be turning against them. By the 1920s, hundreds of American churches participated in a national eugenics sermon contest. As the Reverend Kenneth MacArthur, a winner from Sterling, Massachusetts, put it in his sermon, if we take seriously the Christian purpose of realizing on earth the ideal divine society, we shall welcome every help with science, which science affords. So I thought that was so wicked. An interesting quote that even within the church, it was making some headway. As you think through even just the way that the church is breathing the cultural air and being affected by it, I think it's something that we should contemplate ourselves.
I got two quotes to share from Andrew Peterson's book, Adorning the Dark. I think I have probably by now already ranked this, but I do want to just go back to these two quotes. This book is on the creative, being a creative person and writing. And I remember the first time that I consumed this book, I listened to it and I enjoyed it. We were doing that in purpose of Andrew Peterson being a guest on the podcast. This time I've been reading it, which allows me to mark in the book, which I have missed doing audiobooks, and then also write a summary statement at the end of each chapter. So this is one of my rereads for 2024. He talks in the chapter on serving the work. He talks about how when you write something, you're serving the creation that you're making. And so sometimes it gets out of hand and it's not what you wanted it to be. And that's very holistic the way you end up making these things creatively. But in the midst of that, he talks about the conflict or tension between art for art's sake and some sort of an agenda that you're trying to do. Now, there's a book called, oh man, it's by Francis Schaeffer's son, Frankie Schaeffer. Man, what is it called? But in essentially, he says, any kind of time you make Christian art to tell something about Christianity, that's just propaganda. And I think what he's seeing is the bad side of that. And so kind of there's this swing against that. So there's art purists and there's like, let's use agenda. And if you do that too much, it feels like propaganda. All right. So that's what he's talking about. He says, he's quoting Madeline L'Engle, and she says that good art is by definition, not necessarily Christian art. It's actually good art. And yet all art that is good art is Christian art because it's capturing what God wanted us to. So she kind of has a problem with agenda. It sounds like I didn't really read that very closely. But here he says it's okay. He thinks it's okay to have agenda. I mean, obviously, look at Wingfeather and all his songs. But he does give this caution. He says agenda is bad when it usurps beauty. Christian art should strive for a marriage of the two. Just as Christ is described as being full of both grace and truth in John 1:14, truth without beauty can be a weapon. Beauty without truth can be spineless. The two together are like lyric and melody. This is not to say that beauty itself isn't a kind of truth, nor that truth isn't itself beautiful. It'll take a better philosopher than me to parse all that out. Hopefully, though, you see my point. There is a purist approach to art, in which the artist is expected to simply create for the sake of creating, making beauty for its own sake. The artist operates with abandon and is loath to interact, or to interfere, or try to control the wild impulse of the art. It does have a certain romance, but we're not merely artistic, creative creatures. We're rational, articulate creatures too. So why not bring both to bear? And I thought that was an interesting quote where if you're being creative, it's not wrong for you to try to infuse Christianity into that or even reflect your Christian worldview. All right. Last one on the creative process. He just explains, he's reading a paragraph by Roald Dahl, who's a great Christian or a children's book writer. And Roald explains how hard it is to be an artist. He's like, there's no one to make you go to your desk and write. There's no one like hounding you. Like if you don't show up, you don't get it. And then when you go that, it's so hard. And he's like, that's why writers drink so much whiskey, you know? And it's like, just to calm down, I'm like, horrendous. Oh boy. Yeah, that's horrendous. All right. So Peterson says this, he says, I wasn't expecting, am I on the wrong page? Hold on. Here we go. He talks about like actually writing that. But then he's at this point talking about why are you going through all this struggle to write? Okay. And he says this, those of us who write, who sing, who paint, must remember that to a child, a song may glow like a nightlight in a scary bedroom. It may be the only thing holding back the monsters. The story may be one, may be the only beautiful true thing that makes it through all the ugliness of a little girl's world to rest in her secret heart. May we take that seriously. It is our job. It is our ministry. It is the sword we swing in the kingdom to remind children that good guys win, that stories are true, and that a fool's hope may be the best kind. If you're called to do this sort of work, then keep those dear ones in your mind as you fight your way up with the long mountain of obedience. You'll be tempted to slow down or to take an easier route, but it's only by discipline that you'll finish. And it's only in finishing that you'll be able to offer up your humble work to those weary souls who need it. Now, this is in a chapter on discipline in writing. And I thought it was a good reminder. You had to press for both your books. You had to work really hard. The initial idea came to him and you had to push. Charlie, you had a great idea, but man, it took lots of effort to get your book written.
It's so much work to write a book and to get it published. I mean, it is. People have no idea.
Yep. But in the end, that book ends up being an extension of your ministry. And so his point is it's not all romance and feelings and lightning striking at the perfect moment. It's like a lot of hard work.
Right.
Yep. So I just thought there's stuff in this book that's good to keep reviewing if you're trying to do anything creative. And I thought those two pieces of advice were good.
Yeah. What he wrote there was really creative too. That was nice. The little girl in the nightlight mm-hmm. and remembering that the good guys win and all of that. That's really inspiring.
All right. So I have actually two quotes.
I think I'm so excited.
The one is definitely going to give it away.
Okay.
But I'm going to see if you can guess what this is from the more difficult of the
two. Do it.
So, are you ready? This is the tough quote. There was a king with a large jaw and a queen with a plain face on the throne of England. And there were a king with a large jaw and a queen with a fair face on the throne of France.
The Tale of Two Cities?
It is. That's the start of paragraph two.
So, I had no idea.
So if neither of you had any idea
know,
from that,
yeah,
I would
I know
have said,
the other one you're going to
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. But wow, good for you, Tim.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Tim, well done, man.
So I will comment on Dickens, Tale of Two Cities. I'm not very far in, but like the first, I think the first section... Yeah, book the first recalled to life is like 35 pages, and I'm through that. And I will just say he is not easy to read.
Wow. Okay.
And so having performed a play based on one of his books, you kind of know a little bit about who he is, like how he does things. And even some of the phrasing is similar to the Christmas Carol. Like you can, if the, like you read it and you know, oh yeah, this is the same guy that wrote this over here. But man, it's just, it's hard to stay with him. It feels very Melville-ish. So
my son Josiah read Tale of Two Cities. And he said that he really struggled like through the first half of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second half of the book was really, and then he kept going back to the beginning of the book because he was able to start piecing it all together.
Yep.
I think it's one of those books you need to read two times.
Yeah, probably.
So that's good. So maybe he should have a year of rereading.
A Tale of Two Readings.
Tale of Two. That's what I should have called my year this year. Oh, man.
Oh.
We'll see. I will make it through it at least once, but I'll probably read through it again. But there's some good, he paints a picture well, but it's not an action book, at least at the start. So
it gets there.
It's not an action book.
But it does get compelling into like the fourth or fifth chapter where you start kind of seeing the plot ideas start to stand up on their own and where you're going to interact with some things. So, but anyway, yeah, something I've been reading recently, Tale of Two Cities.
Let's have a conversation about Proverbs 31. I'm going to go ahead and read just the first 9 verses. The words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. What are you doing, my son? What are you doing, son of my womb? What are you doing, son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to take strong drink. Lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the law, the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all who are destitute. Open your mouth, judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. So that's the first 9 verses. I guess I'll read verse 10 as well. An excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. Okay, so I'm going to just kind of interact with you guys and we'll talk through this passage. It's a passage that, I don't know, when people mention Proverbs 31, they usually are thinking verses 10 and following, the hymn to the excellent woman, the virtuous woman, the valiant woman, however you take that word. Yeah, we're just going to work through this. And I think the application is actually a lot broader to our listeners than, well, a hymn to the excellent woman. To whom is Proverbs 31 written? Men?
The son.
Yeah, okay. So what does it say there in the first verse?
What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing? Who?
My son.
My son. Okay, so who's doing the speaking?
I'm going to go with parent.
Okay, that's good. Son of my womb.
Well, it says an oracle of the mother.
Right.
But the words of the king.
Right. The words of Lemuel, the king. There's some debate about the oracle which his mother taught him. So it's like Lemuel's words, but it's something that came from Lemuel's mom.
Yeah. So that second phrase, son of my womb, would indicate that the speaker is the mom.
The mom.
Yep.
And what is she doing? She is teaching her son a couple of things. So some contend that this is only verses 1-9, because there's a transition in verse 10 to the hymn to the excellent wife. I believe that this is coming actually from the mother, and it's the mother, the whole thing, to the son. But who's the primary audience? A son. Yet, often when we think of Proverbs 31, who do we ascertain is the primary audience?
Not sons. Nope. Usually, yeah, ladies.
Usually the woman. So just kind of recalibrate our thinking as we work through this. This text is primarily directed towards our sons. Is there some indirect applications for wives? Yeah, sure. Woman, yes, definitely. The hymn to the excellent wife, sure. But as I'm going to go through this, I'm going to be casting this more in the direction of our son, our sons. Okay, so we first have the imperative there in verse 3. Do not give your, what is the word here? What do you guys have in your different translations? What are we not to be give to woman?
Chayil.
Strength.
Strength. Mm-hmm. Okay, do not give your strength. Some have understood this as like virility, but it's the word chayil. Carter evidently has already looked it up. And this idea of chayil, it's a key word in the Old Testament. I don't require this right now. I've thought about on several occasions requiring my students to study key phrases or words in the Old Testament, and this would be one of them. I would encourage you to study out this word, its meaning. It's a very nuanced meaning, like chesed. Chesed is a very nuanced meaning in the Old Testament as well. But chayil means like strength or power, it's might. And often it's like from the things that give us strength. So for example, what makes you powerful? What makes you strong?
Authority.
Okay.
Physical strength.
So those are two different things. So authority. So if you have people under you.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, an army.
Okay.
An army gives you strength because then you have these warriors that can fight for you. And that's why chayil can mean army. Chayil can also mean physical power, strength, because you have muscles and you're strong.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we see that even in the hymn to the virtuous woman later on. She has strength, like muscles, so that she can accomplish things. And so think through the meaning of the word from that perspective. Another is going to be money. Money makes you powerful. It allows you to do things, allows you to make movement. So do not give to women your chayil. And that's why I think understanding the broad definition of the word helps us to understand what's to not be given to women. What's that going to include? Time, money, strength, virility, and don't waste your chayil on women. Now, isn't that interesting that chayil shows up in verse 3? Because we're familiar with the word chayil, aren't we, Carter? And where are we used to it for appearing?
I know we've talked about it before, but I can't remember.
That's okay.
I noticed she didn't ask me where chayil is appearing.
Well, I thought he
appearing.
Was tracking on this because he picked it up in verse 3, which was pretty remarkable. Most people don't know that it is. Do you know?
You have it in the title of the episode.
Do I?
The one you put on the sheet. I've forgotten my Hebrew. That's why I was just making a joke. I was like, you didn't ask me. It's because I don't remember my Hebrew, Tim.
So it's the Eshet Chayil, the woman of chayil. So you have chayil in verse 3. Do not give your chayil, your strength, to woman. But then what do you have in verse 10? A woman of chayil.
Chayil.
Yes.
Ah, wasn't that interesting? So that's why I believe that the entire...
I knew that the whole time. Definitely didn't not know that.
So this is one of the reasons why I believe all of Proverbs 31 is the words of Lemuel's mother, because she's exhorting her husband, don't waste your chayil on woman. Instead, what do you need to find? A woman who herself is chayil. Because what is that woman of chayil going to do? What is she going to do for you?
Strengthen you.
Yeah she's going to strengthen you. Yeah. Ding, ding, ding.
She's exhorting her son.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not her husband.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just, I thought that was a good clarification.
That was a good clarification.
Well, I mean, her husband hopefully has already listened to the admonition.
Precisely.
Yep.
So there's some conversation about here in verse 3. Do not give to woman your chayil, nor your ways, okay, the parallelism, your ways to your chayil, okay? So that's why I also like to include like your time, your effort. Some young men, they're like spending so much time with women, even if they're looking for the godly woman or whoever they're going to marry. And it's just like, hey, you know what? Is there like a a principle here about how much time you're spending with women? What is your primary goal in life, young man? Think about that. Okay. And so don't give your ways to the things that destroy kings. Obviously, the context of Proverbs 31 is an exhortation to kings. And so these individuals who are in positions of power and authority are being exhorted. So as you think through kings that did give their chayil to women, well, got any ideas? Who were some of those guys?
The wisest one.
Shlomo.
All right. He's not the only one either, but he was definitely one. And even David. Mm. Yeah. Think about David and with Bathsheba.
Yep.
And then what transpired. Okay. So to that which destroys kings, what did his sin with Bathsheba lead to?
It really did.
The palace intrigue, yeah. That, yep. Then the assault on Tamar by his son, mm-hmm. Ammon, and then he has to flee for his life because of Absalom. I mean, like all of these things are a result of the failure to obey this command. So that's why this makes so much sense. So you have Solomon. Who else? Anybody else? So.
Well,
Judges. I mean.
Oh, yeah. They kind of all multiplied, yeah. Wives and stuff.
I mean, there's just in general, lots of kings had multiple wives. Like, I'm thinking, yeah. Like Manasseh, I think he had. You know, there's just, I think there's in general, yeah, but.
It was a regular problem that, yeah. The kings had. And so the other one that I like mentioning is Ahasuerus, Xerxes.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. I mean, he's like the paradigmatic Proverbs 31 bad guy. He's got all the girls, and then he has all the, you know, where the text is going is to wine. And he has his big drinking parties with all of his ladies at it and so on and so forth. I mean, he's like the paradigmatic, like, antithesis or example, yeah. Of what not to do.
That's a very good point.
So... nor your ways to that which destroys kings. And it's funny, too, just studying Esther, because the guy's totally aloof. He doesn't have any idea what's going on in his kingdom, which is what Proverbs 31, 1 through 9 is talking about. Yeah. Like, you consume yourself with your woman and your liquor, and then basically you're not judging righteously, and you're a terrible ruler, yeah. And that leads to problems in your kingdom.
Yep.
Okay, so there we have, don't give your chayil. So that's a big part. We'll come back to that with some applications near the end. Now, verse 4, not to kings, Olemuel, not to kings, the drinking of wine, nor to rulers, the strong drink. So I've alluded to this passage in the past, and I think even when I did an alcohol episode, I said, you know, kings shouldn't drink, and here's the verse, and here's the evidence. I'm going to back that off a little bit, okay? Well, you know, when it says in verse 3 that he should not give his chayil to a woman, does that mean he should never marry?
No.
No.
Right? That's a very good point.
Okay, so in verse 4, is it saying that he should never drink? Yeah, think about that one for a moment. So you need to put yourself back in that. Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to go back to our discussions of the nature of what alcohol is and what it would have been like in those days, and Paul telling Timothy to take some wine for his stomach and, right, the purification, yep. Part, but then not drinking.
Precisely. So there's a whole pile of other points. I don't think I'm losing anything from that alcohol episode by acknowledging that, yeah, he would have drank some wine. And plus, what was wine back in those days? And in the ancient world, the health benefits, which is what Andy's talking about here too. So, but would he have drank some wine? I'm like, oh yeah, you know what? He probably would have drank some watered down wine that would have been customary for a king in that day. The issue is, don't drink so much that you're going to be, well, what does verse 5 say?
You drink too much and you forget.
You forget the law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say too, like verse 3, don't give your strength, like don't give your life to something that's, yeah. Going to dominate. And so like if you're all of the time, the predominant action is women and drinking.
Right.
How that perverts the ruler. Or obviously, I think it's almost a categorical distinction that, you know, to find an excellent wife versus giving your strength to women, it's like that getting married wouldn't even be under the category of giving strength to women. So it's like, it's not even like to get married isn't like the one okay step of giving strength. It's like not even in the same zone maybe, but
yeah.
So that, in that sense, like
the word woman is plural,
the proper use of a drink, like in that context, like, I mean, it's almost unavoidable in antiquity.
Right.
But would that fit under the category of strong drink, or is that, anyway, but again, I'm going to derail, but.
No, those are some helpful qualifications. And so that was good. Okay. So then in verse 5, lest he drink and he forget the justice and he change the judgment concerning the, well, what does it say there? The sons of what, the afflicted, or what do you have?
Pervert the rights of the afflicted is what the ESV has. Lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted.
Right. So it's like, oh man, I forgot what I said. And then you're changing the laws. So then the afflicted people, the lesser ones in society, are then not receiving justice, and you're making their position in life even worse. So now then you have this really weird thing, and go ahead, what do you have?
Sorry, that's really interesting, because that side comment actually teaches us a little bit about the responsibility and role of the king.
Yes.
In regards to people who need justice, which also sort of parallels the New Testament understanding of that the government is meant to punish wickedness and reward good things. So carry on. I just thought that was an interesting little side note.
Yes, excellent. So now in verse 6, you have another imperative. Remember back in verse 3, do not give. Well, here we do give. It's mm-hmm. the same word. Mm-hmm. Give strong drink to the one who's dying and wine to the one who is, what, bitter of soul. Mm-hmm. Okay, so kind of interesting. This. Oh, okay, somebody is okay to drink. And it seems to be the pretty strong stuff, at least in the first instance. As Christians, we don't typically have a problem with that first colon because, well, the one who's dying, you know, we're okay with merciful with, it's like an act of mercy, giving them a pain reliever as they're passing away.
Like a pain reliever, I would say like medicinal, right. even, but.
Well, you finish, but I want to add something about that in a minute.
And then that second line there, but wine to the ones who are bitter in soul. Well, who's a person that's bitter in soul?
Someone who's in pain.
It could be somebody who's in pain, and that is parallel with the Ovid, with the perishing one. Okay, so mm-hmm. that's true. It could be a broader category too, though. Go ahead.
And I think the next verse might broaden it. Mm-hmm. Well, I was just, the thing that I thought about with perishing is, and dying, when I read this before, a time in life, I thought, okay, so the one time it's okay is if they're dying, and then you're like, well, what if they're not, what if they're going to die, but you're not sure? When do you break out the alcohol? And I realized I'm thinking anachronistically. Right now, we have pretty clear ways to guess kind of close if someone's going to die or not. But back then, anyone screaming their head off would have been in the midst of dying, and then maybe they just wouldn't die because it was just something pain and they didn't understand it. So I really do think that one, to me, fits the category of anesthesia or pain relief mm-hmm. because someone who's dying on the battlefield of a flesh wound and someone who's dying because they have gas in their stomach and they don't, you know, they need to fart. Sure. Like, I'm just saying, like, you're going to scream in both ways.
Yeah.
And so it could just be that the category is like, hey, someone who's dying, but to us, we'd say someone who looks like they're, you know, in pain. That's how I've always, how I've recently taken it. I don't know sure. if that's fair, but then I'm looking at 7. I'm like,
oh. Right. It kind of gets blown up in 7. So why don't you go ahead and read it, Andy?
Well, it says, let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. So that is looking more at the non-physical.
Yeah.
It's like my life circumstances stink.
Yeah. Life stinks, so, you know, drink and forget it, and so that you don't have to.
Would you have any sense of maybe like, so like the first line is, give the strength to the one who's perishing, but then all of those subsequent lines are further expressing the same idea of perishing. So like, it's not like a social economic status, like, as long as you make less than this, strong drink's okay for you, but it's like, they're perishing in their poverty. So right. like they're starving to death because they can't buy food. So like, that's okay. Like it's an extension of the first line uh-huh. rather than its own category.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it is referring to the one who is, their life stinks because sure. they're poor, which is the context of verse 5. What do you have at the end of verse 5? the sons of affliction.
The afflicted ones. Yeah.
Afflicted ones. And then what do you have at the end of verse 8 and even verse 9?
Destitution and then poor and needy.
Right. So the context is actually the impoverished. But what causes their impoverishment?
The bad king.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yep.
The wicked king.
He's spending the strength in the wrong spot.
Okay. So what happens if he's actually not drinking all the time? And what if he actually does his job and ascribes justice?
Then they don't need it.
Oh. They won't drink all the time. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's good.
Okay. So I actually, some have read this and they're like, man, they must have had like some kind of a welfare program. And just to keep all of the peasants appeased, they just had them, you know,
we call that
free beer program.
We call that beer fair.
Program. Beer fair?
So in that sense, is it kind of like a...
We're not welfare, whiskey fair.
It's a beer fair.
I wouldn't call it a like sarcastic, but it's like, hey, king, don't give your strength to the wrong thing, you know, lest you forget.
Right.
You know, give the strong drink to, and it's like
it's a reductio.
Because you're not doing your job, these are the people that need the drink.
Not you.
So it's kind of like a sarcastic point.
I like that.
You're a bad leader.
That's not bad. So Waelke, I don't agree with Waelke and his exegesis of this. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but he says that there is some sarcasm or something like that going on. You might be right. I'm not sure. But like is the text ascribing or promoting a beer fair type of a program? And pretty much everybody's like, it can't be. Because you have so many prohibitions about drinking and how it further impoverishes the poor.
I mean, you think about the intent of the mother through the king. The point is, be a good leader. Don't be a bad leader.
Right.
I think we would agree it's not intended to set forth an ethic on alcohol.
Correct. So that's a very important point.
Yeah.
And thinking through what is the real idea. Okay. Do you have something else, Stearns, or should
maybe you said this and I missed it, but the command, like there's this question, interrogative, like, what are you doing? And then it's like, why? And then the command is don't give strength.
Mm-hmm.
And then, hey, it's not for kings to drink, give. And so there's a don't give and a give.
Yes.
And I'm trying to figure out, there's two prohibitions or imperative forms of like this. I'm not looking at anything, but there's a give and a don't give.
I know. Those are really,
and
they're structural and there's doing something.
And then you've got like an open a mouth and open the mouth. You're opening your mouth to drink.
Oh, that's an imperative too. You just put it together, didn't you? What do you open your mouth to do? Isn't it great?
Okay, that's beautiful.
You have two imperatives in verses 8 and 9.
Mm-hmm.
Open your mouth. Well, what is the king typically, the bad king, doing? He's opening his mouth to
beer.
To drink. No and instead, way. He needs to shut his mouth to the beer, and he needs to open his mouth to the needy. He needs to open his mouth to justice. He needs to speak for the afflicted and the needy. It's a beautiful poem here of wordplay with the opening of the mouth.
Oh, that's
so you have two imperatives that are giving, don't give a give, and then you have two imperatives, open in verses 8 and 9.
Man, if someone just cherry picked one verse out of the middle of this.
So now,
yeah, like if you did go to this passage, like, see, it says right there.
Yeah.
It's okay to drink if you're, you know, this and this, and you miss the context before, the context after.
Yeah. Oops.
And it's like, that's not what it's not writing specifically about drinking. It's talking about being a good king.
Now, as we think through the application then of this passage, granted, we're not kings, so there's not a one for one.
Speak for yourself.
What are you discovering in your German studies and everything else over there?
I'm just, in general.
So in verses, the whole drinking thing, what is that highlighting? What kind of a life is drinking supporting? Think a little broader than just alcohol. Alcohol, I think, is a metonymy for something. Or a synecdoche.
Well, there's destitution, there's distress, there's poverty, there's perishing.
Right.
There's a level of not justice going on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I might be missing.
So I just brought in the drinking is a synecdoche is a piece of pleasurable lifestyles.
Oh. Yeah, that's what I was going to go
That's
for.
Where you're going.
Okay.
It's a very self-gratifying, pleasure-filled
Precisely.
Pursuit.
Right. And so okay. Then what's that going to do? Well, it's going to manifest itself usually in two ways, the woman and then the booze.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's going to flow into a whole pile of other types of frivolity that's going to lead to the destitution of your kingdom, okay. The perversion of justice. So as we think through just application for a modern audience, you're not a king. Okay. There's some exhortation here concerning wine. We've talked about that. But then the exhortation is also just don't be lazy. Like God has given good gifts that you can enjoy and you should enjoy those good gifts, but you need to enjoy them in their proper proportion. Enjoy God's good gifts, but don't live for them. They can't be God's. Okay, so those are a couple of the applications. Now I'm going to kind of finally just get to the Proverbs 31 woman. I'm not going to go through everything with the Proverbs 31 woman. Okay, I want to hit on a component of it and then we'll talk about it. So here in verse 10, she is the woman of Chayil. Okay, and who can find this woman of Chayil? Her value is far beyond rubies. Now, this kind of objective description, which some people really don't like. I mean, her value is far beyond rubies. What is what does the ESV say there, Stearns?
Well, I'm sorry, what verse are we in?
31:10.
An excellent wife who can find, she's far more precious than jewels.
So precious than jewels, that's kind of a nice way to say it. The word there is literally like her value, her cost. It's like a money term, which is pretty offensive to our modern audience. But in the ancient world, what would the ancient man do, particularly if you were a king? You'd have to pay the bride price and buy a woman.
Oh, that's right. That's right, the dowry kind of
thing. Right, and so if you find a woman that's like an Eshet Chayil, the woman of virtue, it's just like, well, she's worth an astronomical amount, okay? Because she's not just somebody that takes Chayil. She increases your Chayil. And so it kind of is, they find it offensive. I just say, it's like ascribing a value to her that's immeasurable. It's like a really good thing. Do you have the old KJV there?
Yes, I do.
What does it say?
Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies.
Her price. See how they translated it, price?
Yep.
That's actually a better translation of the Hebrew word, but a little bit offensive to our modern audience. Okay, so I want to highlight the husband here. Okay, in verse 11.
King Jay knew what he was doing.
Verse 11, the heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. Okay, do you see the idea of gain? As opposed to the idea of loss from the previous girl, this one is going to produce gain for him. Verse 12, she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. I mean, we could go through a pile of stuff on the details of the Proverbs 31 woman and verses 10 through 31. It's an acrostic. She's literally the A to Z woman. It goes through the alphabet of the Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, okay, the first letter of each word. And there's like a chiasm in it. There's a ton of fun stuff in here. So I'm not going to exhaust all of that. Study it out for yourself. It's really good. If you guys have something you want to jump in on, then, you know, you can go ahead and do that at any time. Where else does the husband show up, however, in the text?
31.
In 31. Okay.
No,
that's not the only time.
No, but it's another imperative.
Give.
It's give. Oh, no way. This is incredible.
What's the Hebrew word for give? Do you remember it, Carter?
Natan,
he got it. Good job. Well done. Natan. Okay, in the
that
imperative.
Noon likes to disappear a little
it
bit.
It does. Okay, so that means because the noon disappears, you get a tav, which is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. It's the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet.
Because it's it's the imperative form.
Yep, you got it.
The other time to answer your question is 23, when he's known at the gates.
Yeah, and why is he known in the gates?
Well, because he's a
why
good
is he
guy.
In the
he's
gates?
A wise. Oh, he's doing his business.
Okay, that's the place where business is transacted. So that is one thing.
Oh,
he's
an elder of the community. He's honored.
Yeah. So, you know, it was like king in verses 2 through 9. Now it's clearly like, okay, a broader category of a man.
Among the elders.
Exactly. Okay.
Verse 28, the husband is there.
Yeah. So he is praising her. Okay, verse 28. But I want to highlight specifically like verse 23. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. What enables him to be in the gates and fighting for the justice of the afflicted and doing the things that a man should be doing, what's empowering him to be there in the gates?
His wife who's back home.
His wife who's back home. And what is she doing back home?
Strengthening him.
She's strengthening him. Yeah, she is. Okay. In the vast, you know, chayel, that's good. That's good. And she's doing that by managing the household. She's doing that by doing all the things. In that ancient world, typically, you know, you'd have servants, okay, employees, servants, whatever. You'd have the children, all right? But because she is a woman of chayil that makes chayil and then allows him to be, do his job. And this is, I think, even an application, particularly for men. It's something to think through. Well, if you are the husband and you need to husband your wife, okay, well, then what does that include? Well, you have a responsibility to empower her, to strengthen her strengths, and to build up her weaknesses. And then in discipling your wife and building her up, you are then enabling her to kind of help you to do the ministry that you need to do. How are we doing? Are we okay?
Following you. Yep.
So I had one conversation with a young man. And this can manifest itself in a lot of different ways. And there has to be a lot of humility and then care, because some people can really take some of what I'm going to say here and run with it and apply it poorly. But the man of chayil, the man of virtue, he lives a Christ-like life. He loves his wife like Christ loves the church. And he loves her and he cleanses her, he sanctifies her, he builds her up. Okay, I'm using language from Ephesians 5, so you're going to have to wrestle with that if you don't like that language. And then in doing so, he's empowering her to then be a servant, to be a minister to the community, to do the things of the Lord. And then as she is doing the things of the Lord, what does that then empower him to do? The things of the Lord, okay? So one young man, I was talking to him, and he was seeking to love his wife well, and he was a young husband. He was a good guy. He was telling me about how he's trying to help out around the house and doing this and doing that. And I kind of was getting the gist that his definition of being a good man and a godly husband was to basically do all the work. And so I kind of started to push back a little bit with him. And I'm like, you realize, you know, your wife can do things. It's not your job to just make her life easy so that she can sit on the couch and eat bonbons all day. And he kind of took that and he was like, yeah, you know what? I haven't really built up my wife. I am not discipling my wife. And I'm like, exactly. See, the Proverbs 31 woman can only really flourish under a husband who's willing to allow her and empower her to be that type of a woman. And he realized that actually he had a huge resource at his disposal, a godly woman who's trying to breathe a Proverbs 31 woman. And what did he need to do? Let her. He needed to like give it over to her to then be that kind of a girl. And so what have I taken from this? You know what a man needs to do? You need to steward your wife's, I'm going to use the word substance, okay? She is a resource, your most valuable resource, and you need to steward that resource for the glory of the Lord. Spend time with her and build her up. Teach her the truths of God's word and disciple her. You are her primary discipler. And then equip her and let her shine. You know, we kind of hit on it. The husband shows up in the gate, and then where does he show up again? What does he do?
He praises her.
He praises her.
He's honoring her for her substance.
Precisely. And then praise her. Praise her for the ways that God does use her, encourage her. The Proverbs 31, you know, we think of it being as something, hey, woman, do this. Yeah, there's some of that, okay. But even more than that, I think it's more of, hey, guy, you need to be this type of a guy. Don't waste your chayil on woman. Invest in that chayil woman.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.